Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Alexis McLeod, and Sarah Tyson. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Miguel Heras Escribano, research fellow at the University of the Basque Country. His new book, The Philosophy of Affordances, is just out from Palgrave Macmillan. Ecological psychology is one of a number of contemporary theories that explains the mind in terms of embodiment and environmental situatedness, rather than inner symbol manipulation by brains. J.J. Gibson, a founder of ecological psychology, coined the term affordance to express a core concept of the view as embodied, situated organisms. We do not perceive objects, but rather possibilities for action. That is, rather than simply seeing a chair or a tree, we perceive the object as something that is sit-onable or climbable. In his new book, Heras Escribano elaborates the basic idea of affordances as directly perceived possibilities for action available to us in an environment, and considers the relation of affordances to values, the type of ecological information that we perceive, the nature of agency from the ecological-psychological perspective, and a political dimension to affordances. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Manuel Heras Escribano. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, Gary.
So I'm really looking forward to talking about your new book, A Philosophy of Affordances. Before we get to the book itself, this is a lot to talk about, maybe you can give us a bit of background about yourself, how you came to philosophy, and how you came to write the book.
Well, I did my undergraduate studies in philosophy at the University of Granada in Spain. And there I was really interested in the philosophy of mind and the cognitive sciences. So after my undergraduate studies, I studied two masters, one master in logic and philosophy of science at the University of Santiago de Compostela, where I studied a lot of philosophy of mind and philosophy of cognitive science. And I realized that if I wanted to delve into the philosophy of cognitive science, I should acquire some training in science. So I studied a master in neurosciences at the Medical School of the Autonomous University of Madrid, which is, in Spain at least, it is quite strange for a humanities student to enroll into this kind of medical studies. And there I acquired this background, and I started to study my PhD back in Granada, again, at the University of Granada. And at the time, I met the Perception and Action Research Group at the Faculty of Psychology of the Autonomous University of Madrid. So, and they are the only research group on ecological psychology in Spain. So I was fascinated by ecological psychology and how the mind and cognition and experience is understood from that perspective. But at the same time, I realized that somehow, although there are a lot of authors that try to connect ecological psychology with the philosophy of mind, there were still some blind spots and there were still some questions that remain unanswered and connections that were not established among between the two disciplines. Mm-hmm. So I talked to my PhD advisor, Manuel de Pinedo, at the University of Granada, if it was interesting to write a PhD thesis on affordances and the philosophical aspects of affordances. And he said that it for sure that was really interesting. So I wrote my PhD on the issue, and that was some kind of initial stage of the book we are going to talk about today. So that is quite my history.
Yeah, very good. So you've mentioned ecological psychology. I mean, the concept of an affordance was coined by J.J. Gibson, right? One of the founders of ecological psychology. So maybe just to get us started, can you say a bit about what ecological psychology is, what the main commitments of it are?
Well, as you said, ecological psychology was a discipline in the experimental branch of the psychological sciences that was pioneered by James Gibson, but also by his wife, Eleanor Gibson. And basically, ecological psychology is a third option beyond cognitivism and behaviorism for understanding the mind. And the principles of ecological psychology are strongly oriented towards embodiment, situated cognition, and a non-representational approach to the mind. So it is getting some interest from the people who are working on the 4E approach to cognitive science and the extended mind and activism and the like.
Okay. So what, you know, you just described it as a kind of a third way between cognitivism and behaviorism. And I guess that's, could you maybe sharpen that distinction? I mean, what, in the book, your main opponent sort of is cognitivism and not behaviorism. And in fact, sometimes it's hard to distinguish, I think, between a behaviorist perspective and a ecological psychological perspective. So could you contrast it with those two, particularly, I think, cognitive?
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ecological psychology basically claims that perception is continuous with action, something that is quite opposed to the views of behaviorism and cognitivism, at least at the time in which the Gibsons developed the discipline. Because as Edward Reed, a philosopher and ecological psychologist, claimed, behaviorism and cognitivism have a lot of things in common, such as, for example, the idea that perception is a passive process in which our senses are impinged by external environmental stimuli, and we just passively received that information. Something that it's really interesting when you see the history of psychology from this perspective is that cognitivism was the critique of cognitivism against behaviorism is not that the stimulus response schema was wrong? Is that the stimulus response schema was insufficient? You have to include a huge load of inner information processing in between perception and action. But ecological psychology claims that that shared idea of the passivity of perception shared by cognitivism and behaviorism is not accurate, because perception and action are a continuous process, and what you perceive is affected by how you act. And also how you act affects what you perceive. So it is some kind of continuous, cyclic, and spatiotemporally extended process that should be taken as such from a temporal perspective, and it is not a series of discrete abstract steps as in a machine or an engine. In fact, ecological psychology is strongly against the computer metaphor, the idea that our mind works as a computer. It is ecological psychology is much more oriented towards the idea that the mind is something that we do with our skillful activity, rather than an inner brain process, for example.
Okay. Oh, that was helpful. So let me just ask. The focus is on perception, and affordances are, you know, very much, you know, a matter of what we see, but. One of the questions, I guess, you know, coming from a more cognitivist perspective, is, you know, the extent to which ecological psychology is trying to be a kind of a complete psychology, or if it's just saying we should, you know, perception is not a passive process. There, we perceive more, we perceive affordances, you know, specifically, but it needn't claim that it's the whole sort of story of what goes on. Are you of the opinion that ecological psychology is giving the whole story, or is your position a bit more modest?
Well, to be fair, ecological psychology has focused on perception and action, and it is a discipline that has been truly focused on those processes. But there's a lot of empirical evidence gathered over the years on those processes. But at the same time, I think that it is not just an experimental branch of psychology. It is not just an experimental approach. It also includes a whole new set of concepts. Among those concepts, the concept of affordance, of course, and those concepts are so powerful so that they can reconstruct our way of understanding the mind. So I think that even when we do not have evidence of empirical evidence, I mean, of different cognitive processes from an ecological perspective, I think that ecological psychology is a really promising approach that in the future will gather evidence for offering a whole picture of the mind as based on the principles of ecological psychology. And in fact, now there have been some research on that direction. There are papers on the idea of memory from an ecological perspective, also special issues on journals on language from an ecological perspective, but there's no strong evidence or a strong research experimental program for offering a complete picture of the mind in those terms. but I think it is really promising.
Okay, good. Good. So let's talk about affordances, right? What are they?
They have been vaguely defined as the possibilities of action, for action that we find in our environment. But if we want to be more accurate, I would say that it is a new object of perception that is based on a new understanding of how environmental aspects are related to our bodily capacities, be them a skillful action or some the size or of different parts of our bodies. So, for example, if I have a glass of water in my desk right now, when I perceive that glass of water, I do not just perceive the shape or the color of the glass or something, but I also perceive the possibility to catch it, to grasp it. And and the possibility of grasping it is based on the shape of the glass as related to the shape of my hand and my grasping capacities, which are bodily based. So it is a new way of understanding how we relate to our environment and how we are coping with our surroundings or dealing with our surroundings thanks to our action.
Okay, so you say we perceive these affordances directly. So when I look at my cup or I look at a tree or something, what I see is something that's grabbable. I don't see what I would use the term cup for, or I see something that's climbable. I don't, or do we see that in addition?
No, I wouldn't say that we do not see that in addition, in the sense that we perceive the object as such, let's say, and then we add some kind of capacity that we have after some inner reflection. What Gibson said is that unreflectively, when we deal with our environment, we perceive those as those things, those affordances, as long as we perceive everything else. So I perceive the color of a cup as directly as I perceive the graspability of the cup. And that has to do with the way in which ecological psychologists analyze the different aspects of the environment from a relational perspective. So scientifically, they have a whole story of how to understand this capacity of grasping as related to different elements of the environment. And if there is some relation between the shape and different aspects of the objects that surround us, then based on a history of interactions between me and my environment, at the end, I would perceive directly that capacity for that opportunity for grasping the object.
So when you contrast this view with the passive process of cognitivism or behaviorism for that matter, so I guess where is the activity in the perception, I guess, is my question.
Uh-huh.
Do you see what I'm... So perception is a passive process for the cognitivist, so presumably it's an active process for the ecological psychologist. And so I'm wondering, what's the action, the active part of the perception? It sounds like, I mean, this might, you know, be a more cognitivist type perspective, but it sounds like something in the organism is going to be added, in the perceptual processing, and that's what makes it an active process.
Well,
Do you see what I'm asking?
From an ecological perspective, how we perceive does not start with the passive reception of a stimuli, but on the other hand, they start, the ecological psychologists start with the idea of an organism surrounded by an environment. And for example, if I perceive the possibility to pass through a door, let's say, then the starting point is not how the light impinges in my senses, and then the information is transmitted so as to form a representation and use it to make a plan and execute it or perform my action. The story starts from a different starting point. We are active explorers of our environment. So when we explore the environment, we deal with the structure of light, let's say in a room. And I want to go, let's imagine that we are in a room, well illuminated room, and we want to pass through the door and go to another room, let's say. So the idea is that the light in the room reverberates so as to form a pattern of light. And when I explore the room, in every point of the room, I access some kind of in some aspect of the pattern from a different perspective. And there are transformations, but there are also continuities in my perception. And what it's continuous in my perception reveals the surfaces of the of my surroundings. And I use that pattern of light, that the structure of the pattern of light to guide my action. And as I act, then I encounter new environmental aspects due to this configuration of light. And as long as I move, I perceive these different affordances due to the configuration of the light in the environment. So in this sense, every time I act, I am modifying, let's say, the way in which I access to the available environmental information, and I perceive different affordances as long as I act in the environment.
Okay, and then I guess this kind of goes back to a question I was raising before, but suppose I'm, sitting quietly in a chair with my eyes closed and I'm doing a sum, some maths in my head. What, how does or might ecological psychology explain that sort of processing?
Well, I think that, as I said at the very beginning, ecological psychology is strongly focused on perception and action. And I would say that there is no, by now, there is no official way of well, let me rephrase that. The idea is that what really matters in our way of knowing the environment and getting information from the environment and being cognizers, let's say, is what we do in the environment. How do we move so as to perceive different available affordances in our environment? Those cases in which I am quietly resting and then I have pictures in my mind, or I'm making abstract mathematical calculus or something, are not the proper object of study of ecological psychology. I think that there should be a story about that, but it would be dependent on the way in which we interact with our environment. So, what I think is that, well, these are abstract, for example, abstract mathematical thinking and stuff and related areas are not still yet studied by ecological psychology as much as it studied perception and action. So maybe I think that in the future we will have a consistent story based on empirical evidence, but I think that by now it should be rooted in our active capacities. So maybe there's some kind of process that can be decoupled from online activities, and maybe that could be understood as an evolutionary advantage that is somehow rooted or based or nested in our primary active capacities, I would say.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. So let me ask one of the things that you've written about elsewhere, as well as the book, is the idea of normativity in affordances. I mean, one of the striking quotations from Gibson, I think, was the idea that he coined the word affordance, you know, to express the word value, and, you know, that we perceive value in some sense. So this idea of value, of course, brings in normativity, and normativity is notoriously difficult to explain in a naturalistic manner. So could you say a bit about how affordance, you know, the relationship that you see between you know, the normativity of what we see and affordances, how does ecological psychology you know, naturalize this idea of normativity?
Okay, my own view on the issue is that, for example, in the book, I say that I deal with normativity in a sense, in a very special sense. As I wrote in the book, I trace back some key ideas that are implicit in the pragmatist and in the analytic tradition in philosophy. And this idea of normativity is built upon those features. The normativity I focus on in the book is of a social kind. Is the idea that we have some shared practices that guide us to relate to each other and to prescribe how we behave, socially speaking. There's another bunch of authors who claim that affordances are normative in a sense. For example, Anthony Chimero claims that affordances are normative relations in a sense. Or, for example, other authors that were not into or within the ecological tradition, such as phenomenologists like Hubert Dreyfus, or Sean Kelly claim that affordances are normative. But I think these are two different senses of normativity. I think that the strong kind of normativity that I refer to, social normativity or shared normative practices, are different from the way in which someone could claim that affordances are normative in a natural sense. Because I think in that respect, there's a confusion there between normativity and lawfulness. I think that when authors in different traditions, such as enactivism or even teleosemantics, claim that there's a normative aspect in, let's say, affordances, they refer that they are that is a phenomenon that is related or explained by a lawful regularity or a scientific theory, such as natural selection, for example. And I think that we should keep these two senses apart. And I would say that affordances in the social sense, they are not normative. They are aspects of the environment, as I said, related to your capacities, but there is no prescriptive force in that, or socially based prescriptive force in the way we perceive them. But there's some kind of influence of our social norms on how we take them. And our social norms can preclude us from taking them. For example, if we are having lunch and I perceive the possibility of grasping the food with my hands, let's say, our social norms of how we should have lunch force us or exert some kind of pressure on us for use the fork and the knife. So well, we can perceive a lot of possibilities for acting, but the way in which our social normativity affect us as human beings is that is on the way in which we take them. They regulate the way we take them, but not the way we perceive them.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
But wouldn't social differences then, I mean, that raises a really interesting aspect, which to my knowledge hasn't been explored, although maybe it has been, but the idea that instead of talking about like human perception, we should really be talking about like, you know, male perception versus female perception, or, you know, upper class perception versus lower class perception, or, you know, in other words, depending on where the human, the particular human is situated socially, they're going to perceive very different sorts of affordances, and talking about human perception is really just too vague or broad a category to actually capture the sorts of affordances that each of us perceives. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think I wouldn't agree with that. Because, as you know, I dealt with this issue in Chapter 7, where I tried to sketch some kind of political dimension of affordances. It is in a very initial stage, but the idea is that, as I see it, the idea is that ecological psychology, it is really interesting, or the principles of ecological psychology are really interesting for taking a look at our way in which we behave in political terms. Of course, every political problem should have a political solution. I'm not saying that with ecological psychology we are going to solve political problems or things like that. I'm just saying that the emphasis on agency, the emphasis on action, and the emphasis on our constant dealing with the environment could illuminate some political problems that we have and see them through other perspectives that emphasize our active capacities as political actors in our environment. In that sense, what I would say is not that there's a difference between male and female perception. According to the principles of ecological psychology, we would perceive the same kind of affordances in our environment. The thing is, relating it to my previous point on the relation between social normativity and how we perceive and take affordances, I would say that we, for example, males and females, we would perceive the same affordances, but our social norms would exert some pressure in females, for example, for not taking available affordances that are that they would be in principle free to take them. I refer to the studies of anthropologist Barry Thorne in the book, and I try to relate them and I try to understand them from an ecological perspective. For example, Barry Thorne paid attention to how kids behave in the playground, for example, and she noticed that when girls were playing and there were no boys around, they tried to expand into the playground. They took a lot of space, but when boys entered in the playground, they invaded the space of the girls. They pushed them, and they simply forced them to be just, let's say, in a corner talking about their things. So the thing is that both girls and boys perceived the same possibilities for acting in the playground, but our social norms, our let's say the patriarchy of norms, is somehow oppressive. It's really oppressive in the way girls take affordances in that example. For example, they restrict the possibility of girls to use the space as freely as boys. And I relate that idea to man spreading. For example, the phenomenon of man spreading that was viral in the internet months ago, in which males occupy much more space than females in public transportation, just simply because they feel they can, and women are in that sense like pressed to not use the same available space as freely as males. So I think that when you put these cases from the perspective of ecological psychology and affordances, there are some political ideas that can be far more illuminating from this perspective. The thing is that if men and women would not perceive the world in the same way, there would be no, let's say, political frustration in that sense, because each gender would be trapped in his or her own way of seeing the world. The thing is that we perceive things in the same way. That it is why we realize that some social norms are simply oppressive for women in that case, and the same could be applied to class or race or the like.
Okay, so that's good. But, you know, it's one thing kids in a playground or even men and women in a subway car or something. But by the time, let's say, you have girls who are then like 15 or 16 or something, and you have you know, these sorts of social norms, you know, sort of repeated. Wouldn't that in some way condition, you know, what you perceive as possible for you? You know, just thinking, you know, say in terms of career, you know, a woman, you know, say 50 years ago might have imagined herself as a nurse, but not as a doctor. You know, so, I mean, that's not a immediately perceptible type of item, you know, like a seat on a subway or a piece of playground equipment. But it is a way of responding to one's environment and being situated in it. And, do you think that, you know, people can actually, you know, come to have different ways of actually perceiving the world, even if that seems to be a separate issue from whether they get trapped in it?
Oh, I see. Really interesting question. Well, I wouldn't say, I think that the use of the verb perceive that you are using there is much more related to an abstract thinking, like how do you imagine yourself in a career path or things like that. But yes, I think that, this has to do with the things that I said before about the relation between perception and action from an ecological perspective and abstract thinking. I think that our abstract thinking can be rooted in our way of perceiving and acting in the environment. So the extrapolations or the abstractions that we have are deeply influenced by the way in which we act and perceive. And this what you say, it could be a case of how social norms are pressing some groups of people to be more sensitive to one possibility rather than another possibility. For example, with girls imagining to be nurses rather than engineers, for example. But I think that has much more to do with our social normativity than to our capacity of perceiving in that sense. So I think that maybe if you, in your development, you are constantly dealing with different oppressive norms that preclude you to take different affordances, in the future, some other kinds of possibilities would seem to you like they are really far from you, but they are actually they are not. Is some kind of social pressure, indeed.
Okay, but so I was trying to think of an example that's more kind of actual perceptual rather than imagining. So, if you have, you know, say a woman, you know, you have a large man, you know, I don't know, coming at you, and a woman might perceive that as an affordance, and you know, it's hard to put it into those terms, but
oh, I see that they would feel threatened,
or something like that. Right, whereas a man might see that as, you know, challengeable so the same actual physical object would afford different sorts of skilled responses.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I see.
What did you think?
There are different cases that I think I would need some more time to reflect about them. But there's the work of a philosopher who is called Saraya Ayala, and she talks about speech affordances, and also she's now dealing with the idea of political affordances as political opportunities that we find in our environment, or opportunities that are in a sense, dependent on our political ideas or reflections. I do not think myself if I would agree with that idea. But it's some kind of expansion of the idea of affordance to other areas. Coming back to the example that you said, that someone would, for example, a female would see would be, for example, in a street, and she would go in the direction, or a person would go in her direction, or something that would be threatening. I think that in that case she would feel much more threatened than a male, for sure. But I think that that also has to do with the history of female people in our society, and how different social norms are affecting them. And yes, in that sense, I totally agree that I would not feel the same if I find the same person as the female in your example. So in that sense, yes, maybe we would perceive some aspects that are different depending on our gender, but those aspects maybe would be much more connected to our social norms rather than to our way of perceiving, I don't know, the shape of something or
yeah. I guess. Well, let me. Yeah. No, it's
It is like that case is embedded of social normativity in a sense.
Right.
But
I was just going to say, you know, so just in the same way that, for example, affordances are, you know, something I perceive relative to the type of body that I've got, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm. you know, it's an embodied, embodiment is an important aspect of it. And it's like a very small person mm-hmm. versus a very large person. And those, let's just assume, are going to be, you know, say a female versus a male. I mean, that alone, if you have significant differences in embodiment, which you do, would itself seem to entail different affordances by the little person.
No, in that sense, you are totally right. But also, it should be highlighted that the female body in this case is totally embodied with the social norms of how women are treated in our society. So there's also social significance in the way we perceive from different perspective or from different bodies. It would be not just a case of direct perception in an ecological sense, but also it would have a socially normative dimension. The examples that I focus on in the book are not related to perceiving other people, but perceiving mm-hmm. situations from different perspectives. And that's why, for example, I described the example of how bathrooms were segregated in the apartheid, for example, or the example of the famous example of Rosa Parks with the seat in the bus. I try to focus on much more ecological based examples in which individuals are related to the environment rather than of how we relate to other people, because I think that it's the next step in this line of research, but I didn't delve into the details now. So that's the that's why your questions are really interesting.
Okay, good. Fair enough. So another thing that you do in the book, besides, you know, your analysis of norms, normativity in relation to affordances, is the idea that affordances are dispositions, and specifically from a Ryleian, Gilbert Ryle sort of approach. Could you explain a bit about sort of metaphysics of affordances in your view?
Well, what I try to do is just to find which would be a suitable ontological candidate to describe the ontological aspects of affordances. And for that reason, I try to relate the idea of affordance to well-established debates in the metaphysical literature, let's say. And what I tried to do was to offer a view of affordances in Ryleian dispositional terms. I think according to different authors, dispositionalism has a problem because for disposition to be well established, they should be related to some eternal properties or Platonic entities, which would be the idea of that disposition in an abstract term. And every disposition that is implemented or instantiated in our world would be dependent on that Platonic entity to be individuated. And I thought that would be a problem, because if you want to offer a naturalistic approach to a certain property or a process or whatever, you have to get rid of extra material Platonic entities. So I tried to do was to reformulate and update the Ryleian approach to dispositions and apply it to affordances. And the idea would be the following. As I said at the very beginning, ecological psychology starts from it doesn't focus on the brain as the key aspects for understanding cognition. The starting point of ecological psychology is the organism-environment relation, the organism-environment coalition, let's say. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. It is based on how different aspects of the environment, for example, energies and surfaces and the like, are related to the organism. It starts with the interaction itself. It's a new way of understanding how organism and environment are related. And affordance is that. It's a way of understanding physical energies in our surroundings, like light, for example, as related to body capacities. So in that sense, Ryleian dispositionalism fits very well into the picture, because Ryleian dispositionalism offers a new vocabulary for understanding what we do, our habits, let's say, in a way that could allow us to make richer inferences. It's an inference ticket in the sense of Gilbert Ryle. The example of Gilbert Ryle that to me is the most the clearest and quite illuminating is with two people looking at a bird, and one says, it is flying south, and the other one says, no, it is not just flying south, it is migrating. They are not pointing to different entities or objects in the environment. What they are doing is offering richer explanations. And what I think that goes very well with affordances is the idea that an affordance is not an extra entity in our world that goes beyond organism and environment. It is not that we have now organism, environments, and affordances. An affordance is a way of describing the interaction between organism and environment that could be treated as an experimental object of study, but it's a new term that allows us to make better inferences in a way that results in a much more illuminating way of understanding ourselves really dealing with the environment. So that is why I think that a Rilean approach to these positions fits very well with the idea of affordances in that sense. And that is why I think that is the best candidate for understanding affordances in ontological terms.
So just to pursue that example of the bird, flying north and then the bird migrating, are these different affordances that are the two people perceiving different things?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that they are perceiving different things, but they are perceiving a bird flying in a direction. But I think maybe the analogy is not in this sense that they would perceive the same shape or the same object going in the same direction. But the idea is that they have a conceptual resource that is much more it is richer for making a fully fledged explanation of the whole process. And I think that affordances understood in this position as dispositions, they are much more interesting, they are richer for understanding how we perceive different aspects of the environment, that they allow us to do different actions in the future. So that is why I think I am not saying that they are the same object of study in both examples, but I think that the spirit of the Rilean idea of dispositions can be adapted into perception and action with the idea of affordance. Like this, they are not extra entities in our world. They are a way of understanding how different entities in our world interact.
Okay, good. I think I have time for one more sort of substantive question on the book. The notion of an agent, right? So there's the embodied organism who is situated in the environment, right? So you talked about the organism environment coalition. But that, also brings in the idea of an agent or some organism that responds in a particular way. Can you say something about the ecological, psychological notion of an agent?
Well, as I say in the book in chapter 5, if I remember, in which I deal with agency, I do not offer a fully fledged theory of agency from an ecological perspective. I just try to offer an initial way of starting to conceive agency from an ecological perspective. Traditionally, in analytic philosophy, agency has been understood in discursive terms. But from an ecological perspective, agency would be understood much more in line with the ideas offered in philosophy of biology or in activism or phenomenology, as an organism who is constantly coordinating its own actions so as to deal properly with the environment, which fits really well with the idea of affordance. So the idea is that an agent in that sense, the agency of the organism, the cognitive agency of the organism, would be shaped by the history of interactions that the organism has established during its development with the surrounding elements. So the surrounding elements are a set of affordances, and the way in which the organism has been dealing with them is shaping the skills that the cognitive skills that the organism is going to develop. And that has a lot in common with Edward Reed's theory of action systems. Traditionally, action systems, from a cognitivist perspective, have been understood in subpersonal terms, like looking the neural connections from the central nervous system to the peripheral nervous system and see how these neural connections are established in discrete steps. But the way in which Edward Reed understood action systems took the organism as a whole and the abilities, the skillful abilities of the organism as a whole, as related to different kinds of affordances. And he claimed that different kinds of affordances demand different behavioral patterns of exploration of the environment, postures and orientations, and let's say. So I think this is a really wonderful starting point for understanding agency from an ecological perspective, not as a set of subpersonal processes, but a set of skills that the individual as a whole possesses for developing its own cognitive identity.
Okay. So we're actually almost out of time. I mean, there's been a lot to talk about, and I do have further questions, but I think I should probably wrap things up. Could you say a bit about what you're working on now, and you know, what's next for you? Are you developing any of the things that you've talked about in the book, or are you doing different projects entirely?
Well, I'm developing some of the ideas of the book, some that are related to the connection between philosophy of biology and philosophy of mind. So now I am funded by the BBVA Foundation, thanks to a Leonardo grant for researchers and cultural creators. And the project is about relating evolutionary processes like niche construction processes to ecological psychology, and in order to establish the principles of what would be called in the future an ecological evolutionary approach to the mind. So I will try to make sense of the theoretical principles of an evolutionary psychology, but including processes like niche construction and understood under the principles of ecological psychology.
Okay, very good. Because yeah, one of the questions that I had was that on the view you described, it seems like an awful lot of natural, you know, organisms of all sorts are going to count as cognitive agents on that view. Which, you know, I think, you know, some people obviously would object to that, but it does seem to be an implication. So anyway, okay, well, we are out of time, but I do want to thank you again for for taking the time to talk with New Books in Philosophy.
Well, thanks for the invitation, Carrie. Thanks to you.
You've been listening to my interview with Manuel Eras Escribano, research fellow at the University of the Basque Country. We've been talking about his new book, The Philosophy of Affordances, which is just out from Palgrave Macmillan. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you again for listening.